This is a discussion of an article in the Christian Century written by Madonna Kolbenschlag, and it's called Abortion and Moral Consensus Beyond Solomon's Choice. I have kind of an introduction to this study. I am aware that this topic of abortion is one in which I don't spend much time discussing. Particularly in groups, I don't spend much time talking about it. I think I don't do that because I'm reluctant to end up in a debate about the issue. And so I find myself avoiding it. And yet I see that as an issue, it becomes more and more a social and public and political issue that affects quite a bit of my life. So I feel that I miss opportunities to discuss and to share my thoughts and hear other people's ideas and continue to form and evolve my own when I don't talk in groups about the issue. And I felt like Holden might be a place where discussion about abortion would be sort of churning and whatnot. That hasn't happened since I've been here, and I think maybe the message there is that, well, Judy, if you're interested in it, you better bring it up. And so I did tonight, and I appreciate you cooperating, I guess, by coming and doing some reading yourself. I wanted to, I suppose, inspire us about getting together around this issue at all. A book that I've been reading this year by Parker Palmer, who is a professor and also, let me see, give you the whole spiel on him. He's a professor of sociology at Georgetown University and dean of studies at Pendle Hill, which is a Quaker community and adult study center, somewhat like Holden. He's also senior associate at the Washington Center for Metropolitan Studies and co-founder of the Institute for Public Life. He has written a book called The Company of Strangers, Christians and the Renewal of America's Public Life. And the title, I don't know why it attracted me, but what I'm finding is the contents sure has guided me since I've been at Holden. And he is saying that the U.S. seems to be dividing itself into a country that has been cultivating its private life and cultivating its political life, and the mediator between the two is the public life, which we seem to be ignoring and crushing almost, certainly losing sight of it. And the public life are those moments in time when people who don't know each other well, who are strangers, get together to inform each other about who they are. And in that process, individuals find out more about themselves because they have the common good to measure themselves against. And I find that that's been true for me, that my public life happens in very few places. Holden is one in which I can chat with strangers and learn more about myself. I want to just say a couple of things that he says about this. He says, my thesis is simple. In a society which lacks a healthy public life, both private and political life will suffer. In the absence of a public which knows and cares about itself, private life tends to become obsessive and fearful, while political institutions become centralized, overweening, and even totalitarian. If we want authentic privacy and authentic politics, we must cultivate the public life on which it depends. He says that Americans tend to be joiners, people who do gather together as strangers, and have done that in their history. We're doing it less and less. But the church is one place in which we do that. And he says, those voluntary associations, like the church, contribute most to our political health when they are broad-based, like a church, which allows people to come together, to share opinions, to influence each other's thinking on a broad range of issues. The health of a democracy is premised on the assumption that the population will not be divided along single-issue lines, that there will be a variety of cross-cutting divisions between us, that you and I will be on the opposite side of some causes, but on the same side of some other causes, and in that way we will come to see that we are related despite our differences. But single-issue groups separate people along absolute lines. They take one concern and make it not only paramount, but apocalyptic. If you are not for or against voluntary abortion, if you are not for or against gun control, if you are not for or against nuclear power, then you are among the damned. For such groups and the people who join them, the world has only one moral boundary. And with this kind of thinking, the idea of a public with complex and interlaced concerns is lost. Now there can be no accommodation, no compromise, no balancing of interests, no looking beneath the conflict for a creative other way. The public disappears, and in its place emerge the righteous and the sinners. And he says the church can help continue to promote public discussion and the pluralism that he sees as critical to our country. And by pluralism, he means that great diversity of opinion and background that we have, and we can do that in several ways as a church. And one way is to not try to consider others as outside of our membership and try to bring them in, but rather to love the world in every possible way as God does, to encounter the vastness of God in all God's truth and complexity, to see the many angles, the many ways of reflecting and refracting the light of the Spirit in our midst. Okay, here's what the point I'm trying to make with reading this. He says, he also says, but when we do that as a church, if we're trying not to gain members, but rather to love the world as God does, then we may slip into sort of a liberal wishy-washiness. We sort of doesn't matter, or we become indifferent. And he says there's a vast difference between openness to new truth and merely being empty-headed. In fact, to refuse to take a stand is to remove oneself from the struggle toward truth, which genuine pluralism involves. To say maybe this or maybe that is to deny the struggle and to remain above the fray. In this way, not only do we fail to contribute to others' thinkings, we also fail to make ourselves vulnerable to their insights. Genuine pluralism does not mean anything goes. It means that every point of view is put forward for corporate testing, and personal openness means being responsive to the results of the test. So, that's why I think it's important to talk about the issue. For me. Also, it's important for me to talk about the issue in public or with other people, because it is because if I don't, I tend to feel like I'm a confused or fuzzy thinker. And that's one thing I don't like to think about myself. I like to think that I know exactly what I think all the time. And then I realize when I start to consider and turn over the abortion question, I feel very muddle-headed. And that makes me feel bad about myself and that I'm not contributing to the public life well. So I was hoping to have an opportunity to talk with other people about it. However, I lack courage because the issue is so controversial. And it wasn't until I read Kolbenschlag's article that I realized that my fuzzy thinking isn't necessarily fuzzy. Perhaps it is holding on to a little kernel of truth that I didn't know how to express before, and that she has put into words some thoughts that I've had but didn't know how to say. And so I guess her article gave me the boost to say, let's look at this a little bit, or I would like to look at this a little bit. And so here we are. Kolbenschlag is a professor at Georgetown University's Woodstock Theological Center in Washington, D.C. She has also written a book called Kiss Sleeping Beauty Goodbye that we have in the bookstore in the library. And in it, it says an interesting thing about her background. When she wrote this book in 79, she was a professor at the university and a member of a religious community of women. based at Villa Maria, Pennsylvania. I don't know which community that is, but she's lived in community. She studied at Notre Dame and John Carroll University and earned her PhD at the University of Notre Dame. She's obviously Catholic. She's worked extensively with groups devoted to women's spirituality and has published in several journals, and this is her first book. What I'd like to do is look at the article. And I know we could discuss the article in a variety of ways. We could discuss how well she argues her point, and that certainly is a valid thing to do. We could also discuss what thoughts have come up for us as we read it, which I hope we do. And also, we can bring forward some questions or new things that we may feel confused about and maybe gain some clarity as we do that. I also want to say one other thing before we look at the article, and that is that abortion is an issue that has become a political issue, is certainly a social issue, and is certainly a personal issue. I don't think there's probably any of us in the room who don't have some personal connection with abortion as a phenomenon in our life. There may be some of us here who have had abortions. There may be friends or family members that we have who have had abortions. We certainly may know people who have had unwanted pregnancies and have had to make decisions about that. We know people who have entered into unintended marriages as a result of unwanted pregnancies, or are now single parents as a result of an unwanted pregnancy or unintended pregnancy. You know, people who have had miscarriages, who are interested in adoption, or who have adopted or given away a baby. So all those kind of reproductive issues, I'm sure, have touched us in some way. And we need to remember that about ourselves and also the other people in the room. Okay. You feel ready to dig in? All right. I brought the dictionary along. You may have noticed, for those of you that did read the article, there were a few words I wasn't clear about, so I had to look them up. Maybe that happened with you too. What I thought I would do is right now go through the article in a brief outline of what I think she's trying to say, and then I hope we can go back and look at the parts of it and bring up, kind of in an open discussion, those thoughts that were generated by what she has written. Okay. Also, if as I go through the outline, if you see that I'm missing something or you see it saw it in a different way, please say so. Maybe we can clarify it as well as we can. I saw three main parts to the article. The introduction was about a page long, and she pretty much says something's going on in our national scene right now that seems to be focusing on abortion, and why is that, and what's going on that's making that happen. I think her basic premise is that patriarchal power in this country, that is power that has been traditionally in the hands of entitled males, and looks like it's being threatened or decreasing or being taken away. Geraldine Ferraro's nomination, for instance, looks like, wait a minute, that kind of shook us up. And what was it hitting at? It probably was, she says, Kolberschlag is saying, it probably hits at that underlying power base in the hands of some males in this country that all of us have subscribed to in one way, shape, or form, but may not like. And that there's some anxiety about that. And for some reason, abortion seems to be able to act like a magnet and pull that anxiety to it. As a result, then, we have some divisions in our culture that can use abortion as its focal point. One of the divisions is created by those power relationships, that is, people who are in the power may be nervous about losing it, as well as people who are attached to people in those power positions, that is, some women, may want to continue to see that continue. Also, she brings up the research that's been done lately in how people reason, develop moral reasoning, Carol Gilligan is one person from Harvard University who has been doing some research on that, and she talks about Gilligan. And she points out the differences that were developed in the research between male reasoning and female reasoning. And I'll just say generally what she says, that male reasoning tends to hold to a primacy of principle, that is, a belief in the fairness and truth of a certain thing, and therefore is greatly concerned with the rights of people because it wants to be fair. So there's a principle that guides one's behavior. In female thinking, there seems to be a primacy of relationship rather than principle. Relationship meaning what is the context of this action, and a concern for all involved, particularly in a caring way, in a non-hurtful way. Out of those two kinds of thinking, principle or relationship, action can occur. She says that the male perspective on principle being the highest way of determining morals or moral behavior, the male way tends to inform our culture. That's the perspective out of which most of us operate. That's what our most ethics professors will come at this issue from. It informs both the pro-choice movement and the pro-life movement. It becomes often an issue of fairness or rights, the rights of the fetus, the rights of the woman. Okay, I think that's what she said in her introduction. Does anybody want to add to that or say anything more? Okay. Then the lengthy part of the article has to do with what she sees as the development of the politics of religious ethics. Of reproductive ethics. She says that because of this power situation, there's becoming an ethic around reproduction in this country, and not only in this country, but in other countries that are similar to us. And she tries to explain those ethics. And she locates four of them, four different kinds. Two of them we're most familiar with, and that is the individualistic norm and the altruistic norm. The individualistic norm is what we would say the pro-choice people tend to operate out of, and that is the belief in the primacy of women's autonomy, or that is, women's autonomy is an absolute. That's where the pro-choice group could talk out of that. They assume a world of rational choice and the ability to act out of rational choice. She says out in both of these, there's bad faith operating. And by bad faith, she says, and that's her whole point, is that we've got something going on here that's wrong. Bad faith has to do with becoming self-righteous about our position, becoming self-projective about our position, that is, putting ourselves in the situation all the time and saying, because of how I would be, that's how all should be, and non-engagement. I can stand back and theorize about this. I think that is what she's saying, as opposed to being really engaged in the issue. The bad faith in the individualistic norm manifests itself because there doesn't seem to be a recognition that real choice may be a myth. There may be no such thing as real, authentic choice in this matter. To assume that there is absolute control over one's destiny in this issue may not be true. And to continue to push women or the culture to believe in control may be another aspect of falling into that sort of perspective that there is one principle that can be operated on and one can act on that always. Also, it seems to deny the fact that there's human limitation and imperfection. That yes, if you have choice, some of us don't choose well, or some of us have some limits to what we can choose. And she says that there doesn't seem to be room for allowing for the serendipitous, for the mystery, for transformation. That in the case of abortion, a person may find themselves pregnant, not desire the pregnancy, in some way or another, transform about that and desire that, or decide that, yes, I can be a nurturing parent and I will be, or something like that. It doesn't allow for that moment that could occur. She said that that's a sign of bad faith. In the altruistic position, which is generally considered the pro-life position, I'm using those words because they're the most common words that we use to label that. That's a belief that the fetus has absolute human rights, full human rights. The bad faith in this position. Now, and it isn't to say that there's not good faith in both positions. She says that too, but she's pointing out that the bad faith is getting us into trouble. That the bad faith of this position is that one is sort of the tactics of it. That if that's really true, then should there be such confrontative, single issue, hard hitting, kind of guilt producing approach to it. What does that say that it's so rigid? Also, that for the Catholic Church, which holds to this position, the Catholic Church is in some way being dishonest wouldn't be the word she'd use, but it's not showing its true colors in the sense that abortion is the stand on abortion within the Catholic Church is a moral teaching, not a doctrine of the Church. But it as often sounds as if it's a church doctrine, but it's actually in the category of moral teaching. Also, there's bad faith in the altruistic approach of the fetus having full human rights, in that there does seem to be some impossibility at the moment in our world of determining when life begins. So to assume that we know that for sure, is not true. It also seems to be inconsistent with the teachings of the Church on social justice. And she makes the distinction between coming out of a choice because of an abstraction or because of experience. With social justice, particularly as we think about Central America, for instance, the Church often comes out of experience of what is going on down there and develops its theory or principle about it. With abortion, the Church tends to come from its theory or abstraction as opposed to the experience in the world with the issue. Okay, I'm almost finished with this outline. Is this helping?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, all right. Okay, so she says, oh dear, we've got this bad faith going on both sides and we're all polarized and we don't seem to be able to find a way to reconcile. Let's hurry up and do that, because if we don't, there's a consequence that seems to be on the horizon, bigger than what either side is trying to talk about. And that is what she calls consequences for public policy, which is that it seems that a whole other norm is evolving all by itself over here away from this argument, but being allowed to develop because of this arguing, which she calls the therapeutic technological norm. And that is the norm that whatever can be done technologically should be done technologically. So if we can create humans in a test tube, if we can have host mothers, surrogate mothers, if we can separate the womb somehow from the people, let's try it. She says that, for her, is the most dangerous thing that seems to be out there. And if we continue to conceive of this agenda so narrowly, we may miss out on what's happening there. So she says, at the same time, though, out of both of these sides seems to be developing among people who are talking, I guess, publicly, a new norm. And this is the one that she would like to propose people start to think about. And this is what she calls co-creation ethics. And she spends a fair amount of time talking about that. Rather than the primacy, the absolute being women's autonomy, or the absolute being the full rights of the fetus, she says the primacy of the co-creation ethics would be the primacy of personal conscience within the context of the common good. That is, we don't live totally privately, and we don't live totally socially. We're in both. And we live within concentric circles of common good, family, nation, world. And that we didn't choose any of those, where we were born, who we were born to, what country we were born in, and so on. We didn't have a choice about that, but we certainly have a choice about our actions within that. I hope we talk a lot about this particular issue, because I think that this is what she's trying to say, and I'm struggling to understand it some. But what she's saying is that if we can develop a co-creation ethic that would be open to the unexpected, to the ambiguous, to the imperfection, to the reality of death as a normal thing, and if we can see the woman and the fetus as a single linked organism, then what does that say about what we should do? Okay, and I think that's where the discussion can go tonight. We can talk about what that implies. And if some of us have some intuitive sense about that already. The third thing she talks about, not for very long, however, is the church's position. And she's primarily talking about the Catholic Church, but I think it well pertains to the church in general in this country. She sees the church in some ways as having some bad faith and also lots of potential. And the potential part of that, she says, is that the church, and that would be us, could create a milieu for people to make decisions that balance between experience and conscience and principle and law, that somewhere in there is where decisions really get made, and that the church can find a way to inform people about that. And the way they can do it is two ways. The church can begin to empower women truly, authentically, to make a conscience choice, to be genuine moral agents, not victims to circumstance that have to quickly decide. And the second thing the church can do is establish or push social policy so that real options for women and for men are possible in this society. And by real options may mean adequate childcare, employment, good housing, and so on. That by not pushing those two things, this dilemma is almost a false one. And then she leaves the question as, will women's experience become the hermeneutic of the future? And so for you theology students, that may be on the horizon. So that's my analysis, or my summary of the article. a lot of words. What does it mean? I guess is what it comes down to for us. I'd like to open it to discussion, and I don't mean just discussion with me, but discussion with each other. So, perhaps we could discuss it in the order that she wrote the article in those three sections. I would hope that the middle section would be the one we could focus on the most. But is there some thoughts that came up for you as either I spoke or that you saw in the article around her introduction about what's going on in this country that produced some thoughts for you? And her analysis of, of our division and moral reasoning and so on.
I accept, I liked the first half of the article. I kind of thought, oh no, I'm not going to agree with anything she says. But the last, her conclusion, I basically agreed with, that the way she framed the problem, I didn't really accept. Because I don't really accept it as a power, that the issue is a power struggle, and it's between, I think she poses it different ways at different points. At one point it's pro-life versus feminism. At one point it's men losing their power. It's not that that isn't an issue, but I can't project that problem onto the way to interpret the abortion issue. So she starts out framing it. She starts the article, and I believe kind of ends it. It's framed as essentially as a women's rights issue, which is the way she sees it. I don't see it that way.
Could you talk about how you do see it? Would talk about it?
I tend to believe a lot of people that are involved, especially most vocally and militantly in the pro-life movement, are probably not very sensitive to feminist concerns. But I believe they truly focus, I believe, on their perception of the fetus as being a person. And if people believe that, you know, 1 to 2 million people are being killed a year, that's enough to explain the emotion, the volatility of the whole thing.
Taking a life is emotional just by itself, regardless of the power positions people might be in. Jackie, did you want to say something?
Do you get the feeling that this buildup of emotion about abortion has come about since, and are the same people who have tried to defeat the ERA, like the Phyllis Schlafly group of people? I mean, they were out to defeat the ERA, and now they're out against abortion. And as it said, it's the women too, the women who want to stay in the home, the women who believe that the man should be in charge of the house and dominate everything. But I kind of get that feeling that a great number of these pro-lifers are the same group of people.
Well, she makes that connection at one point in the article. I don't know if I believe that or not.
I don't think that explains feminists who are against abortion. I mean, I think you're right that there may be a large segment of people who are not in favor of women's rights, and abortion is lumped with that, or they're consistent with that. But I think that doesn't explain the feminists who also are in favor of abortion.
The feeling is so strong today. This has built up over the years. And as the article said, why don't these people concentrate them on some alternatives? Child care for these babies, birth, Planned Parenthood. Sometimes, I'm not saying it's the violent ones, but even having Planned Parenthood places been blown up by pro-life people, which seems so wrong and so violent, that it's kind of frightening.
Yeah, she would label that the bad faith of that position.
But I, I really found it fascinating, I mean, the connection she did make between the abortion issue is almost, I mean, as like a domestic issue, and the larger political issues, meaning that the anxiety over losing patriarchal power, you know, is more pervasive than we think it is. I mean, that there's a connection between that and, you know, kicking ass in Central America is the quote from George Bush that she uses.
Did you want to say more about that?
Do you have any thoughts about the difference between the way males and females might arrive at a moral conclusion? Was that either new for you or interesting to you, or did it strike you as correct? Or?
I think it's interesting. I don't know how substantial the research is, though. Mm-hmm. She says that Gilligan's research suggests this.
It's pretty substantial research. She worked with Kohlberg at Harvard and then discovered that that there were great differences, and then went on to do research of her own. Mm-hmm.
And I'm familiar with the research that's been done, too. It's interesting.
I think for me, the fact that she points out that there's maybe a difference between thinking along the lines of principle and fairness and along the lines of a relationship, feel like me. I feel like I flip-flop between those two things a lot of the time. I certainly do on the abortion issue, and I feel like I do it in other areas, that I can get a principle behind me and I can hold on to it and say, this is absolute truth. And then later on, somehow I've evolved out of that, or I have gained a new insight, or I've encountered another situation and suddenly it's not that anymore. And that's where I sometimes say, gee, I must be fuzzy or confused or whatever. So it was helpful to me to say, gee, there might be different ways to approach a moral decision. Mm-hmm. And that if I don't hold a principle, or a particular principle, or absolutely all the time, that I may not mean that I'm being less than capable in my moral living.
I see the different frames of reference probably more in line like that, but it's one of those situations again where I feel uncomfortable with being male and then having the male perspective, you know, described like that, and wanting right away to think, no, that doesn't describe all of the way that I would do that. So I don't like it, but I think in general I can see it. It's something I want to get away from, I guess.
In response to that, I think the struggle for me is not that either way of thinking is right or wrong, but that if that is the difference, that the struggle would be to make females in general reason one way and males reason another, is to value both equally, and not to make one the right way. And that's the difficult part, because of as I experience it, the power, patriarchal power structure makes us believe that the male way is more valid. It isn't, I don't think it's wrong, necessarily. But if there was some way we could communicate with each other in our way of reasoning and come out making a decision, it would make more sense. But it's a real struggle to always own my way of thinking or experiencing something and say that that's all right. That's the hard part.
Yeah, I think that's where we get caught, is that it's really difficult a lot of times to understand one another. Because we approach a problem so differently.
Mm-hmm.
That a lot of times we are not communicating. We have to back up and start over again. Or translate.
Yeah. The translation.
For me, it's important to make a distinction between, I've heard, you know, Susan, you said like the male way and the female way. It's important to me to make a distinction between the masculine and the feminine rather than the male, which is the men, and the female, which is the women. Masculine and feminine being more sort of behavior characteristics or attributes. Because I think I embody feminine attributes and characteristics too, and so it seems to me that the struggle is set up between the masculine and the feminine, i.e. the masculine being the ways of thinking, the ways of expressing ourselves, what we equate with being power, what predominates in the society is. And the feminine, I think, and that's why I can see it in that way, the feminine being ways of expressing that just don't hold as much water. Maybe the intuitive, in that a lot of times I put spiritual, emotional, that. So I guess I just need to say that I try not to feel like the men are being attacked, or the fathers, or whatever, but a whole way of expressing ourselves as persons. And I like how that comes out later, because it seems like you talked about that. And that's tricky, because I feel that split in me, and I feel that division in me. And those two have a real hard time talking in me.
Yeah, that's...
Mm-hmm. But better to have that within ourselves than to set it up as...
Yeah. And because they have a hard time talking within me, and I can never resolve that struggle, it's very difficult for me to put that out too, and connect with other people in that.
I notice kind of I don't know, it's a small sample, but perhaps it's an historical trend. But I think it was in 69 that the Roe versus Wade decision came about in the Supreme Court sometime around then. New York State was the first state that allowed legal abortions. I was living there at the time and was a graduate student and began to do pregnancy counseling, which included abortion counseling, helping people find ways for getting safe abortions. And what I found in the discussions with people was, I only discussed with the pregnant woman, or occasionally the pregnant woman and her mother, the discussion had to do with just what she said, the relationships that woman was in, that what will happen to my family, what about my parents, what about my boyfriend or my husband, what about my other children, that was the focus of the conversation and of how the decision got made. Since then, as a counselor, and not specifically doing pregnancy counseling, but doing just general counseling and running across women who have had abortions recently, what I've heard more there need to talk about is, did I do the right thing? I feel guilty. More a discussion of the principle of, is abortion murder? And less about the relationship situation. And perhaps both those discussions need to go on inside, but I found as a counselor finding it difficult to find a way for the woman to get at the crux of, why did you make this decision? What was going on in you? Why was it important that you chose this over anything else? It's very difficult to talk about it for all the principle part of it. And so it made me feel that the woman made the decision without knowing herself well.
maybe some cultural pressure, maybe being laid on this bishop. That may be backfiring. I think she talks about trying to help empower women to be moral agents, to be people of authentic conscience. Can we do that if we legislate a certain thing? Could be another question, I guess. Can we move on to the second part, the development of politics of reproductive ethics? It's all many words. But anyway, she has the norms and talks about the individualistic norm of the absolute autonomy of the woman and the absolute rights of the fetus and the possibility of this therapeutic technological norm being developed out of the, or ignoring that piece.
Yeah, I like this section best. I think she underestimated that therapeutic thing. I think she was even scratching the surface of not only what's possible, but what surely will happen. And that's why, you know, we're just being misled if she's saying either this area and letting that happen, it won't be by any governmental decision, certainly no church influence will be done by industry, and they'll make decisions and they'll produce all this stuff. Not only for reproduction, but for the control of the will. And I think she's right on. And then I loved her co-creator, co-creation. I wish you would avoid the word ethics. I think it gets back to principle.
It does,
and,
doesn't it?
And I think it's a, I think it's a bad theological word. I think it's a lifestyle or whatever you want to call it, a way of being. But it pushes itself towards creation as well. Because she not only affirmed the normalcy of death, but even of imperfection, and what was the other?
Dissolution.
And dissolution, which again we have so much trouble with accepting, and it is a part of the nature around us, and I like that connection too. Along with what she said, you know, that for this issue, the moral agency and autonomy of women, primary guardians have to be SPT. That was really neat. Maybe put together in our own. I got the feeling as well as the direction.
She brought up a really important point to me, is the whole technological and creation. That's, to me, that's what the issue is that it is creation and creation of, say, beings and God and the, that sort of relationship. And if we start getting into, if we can produce, it's like that mystery is sort of being taken away, and if we can start producing life, you know, what is that going to mean? And this whole, these, I think these two issues, abortion and reproducing technologically are so linked, and that we're missing sort of the link. And then also the pro-choice and the pro-life people are sort of arguing two different points, and they don't seem to, like they're going like that. And you know, and there's so like pro-life people, they're lumped together, and there's so many people have so many different reasons for being that way. And it's like, she's done a lot of labeling, and I'm not really sure I go along with all her labels.
Mm-hmm. Where would you, you said that people are going like this, where would you see the point which people meet around this?
I can't really, I don't really know.
I know I've had some contact with when I was at LBI with the pro-life people, and they really think that it's God's will and that these other people are just sinners and damned. I mean, they can't even conceive that the individualistic people have sincere motives almost. And they're so self-righteous, and they're sincerely self-righteous though. It's not like, I mean, they just honestly believe that. And it's just really, so I can see why they just don't meet. I mean, they don't even want to be in the same room and talk to them, because they might get contaminated with that. It's almost like that. It's really it's very, they're very strong about that.
But the people you see and hear
would generally be the, you'll hear the extremes from both sides. On the personal level, there'll be the people who are most vocal. And the same in the media, that just feeds in the media's constant need for some, a story is always a conflict between two very opposing viewpoints. So everything's always in the extreme. And I think the majority of people are much more complex. I think of, you know, someone like my mother, she would look at abortion, she'd pass this and like, wasn't that awful? You know. But then it's going to give her individual cases, and then she said, yeah, but you know, with this person, you know, I can see where that would be a real struggle. And the majority of people, I think, are like that. But I think the media has a profound effect on our perception of the whole thing, and I agree that she goes along with this in this article, and, you know, it's pitting, you know, people are here or they're here.
I think I agree with that the complexities is maybe where people meet when they can begin to dialogue about the situation that then we somehow connect around the pain of this or the anguish of this or the hard choice about that, and then we may open in some ways. But I think the hard part for me has been this year is knowing that I want to live a nonviolent life. I want to be nonviolent, and that many of the people that I would link as sort of allies with me, comrades with me, Daniel Berrigan, for instance, would be someone who would not approve of abortion because of it seeing it as an act of violence. And that has been a dilemma for me. I mean, I don't, you know, some of you know that I don't even push mosquitoes or you know, step on ants and things like that. So, I mean, it's like life is sacred for me. And I've been mulling this over and saying, what does it, you know, where does Kolbenschlag say anything about this, you know? And she has a sentence, and it's that it would help us to regard death, imperfection, disillusion as normal phenomena in the continuum of life. That's what she says about it, I think. And I thought, oh, Madonna. And then my cat let yesterday, who I love and who wears a bell because I don't want him to eat birds, and squirrel. His bell got off him yesterday. And I walked up the porch, and he's standing right in front of the front door, and he's got this squirrel hanging out of his mouth. He looks at me, he's got the head in his mouth, and he bites down on the head, and the blood squishes, and the bones crack, and he chews on the head. And I think, okay, I'm trying to raise a nonviolent cat, and he just ate the head off. You know, and I mean, this, I mean, I know it's ridiculous, but Gandhi, I'm reading Gandhi, and he talks about what we eat, and the plants we eat, and the organisms we breathe in, and sort of the constant death, the constant killing that we live amidst. And it's hard for me sometimes to say, to say much about that, but I think that's what she's saying here in this one thing. Yeah,
I haven't read the article, but something that struck me or strikes me throughout the conversation is the word co-creation. It seems like sometimes that maybe we get off on a tangent and we forget the word co. And you think that it's just God who creates, or it's just we who create, and trying to find how that fits together, the co-creation, and that God is God and we are people. I think
in it together,
a big theological kind of way of thinking of life itself and death itself, and God and we as people. It seems like maybe pro-choice or the other would come off as just seeing as God is sole creator, or as just as we as soul Mm-hmm. And it's a struggle, I think, to try to put those two together.
Thanks for saying that.
I remember while they're looking at a sojourner's and a few of the letters and other things they've gotten, you know, a magazine like that takes on a lot of volatile issues. Almost forgotten about abortion or has really left it out of their pages. And it was kind of a, you know, from Wallace or something, almost kind of an apology or an explanation of how difficult it is for the community themselves to express this. And part of it being their reluctance to end up on the same side as some folks in the New Right or something, because they're so used to anything the New Right thinks, the Right article to get, you know, in total opposition to it or something. And here all of a sudden, if they call themselves pro-life, which we all want to be pro-life, right? I mean, the names themselves are unfair, I guess. But, you know, to line yourself up with what that means, as far as the groups right now and everything else, is really dangerous and could be really damaging too. And the things that were brought up are things that I think are so important too. You know, what happens once we do save these lives, you know, keep abortions from happening, and we stop right at, does our care for the life and the fetus and everything end right at conception when the person is born, you know, and then we start cutting off our, you know, our child care, lunches for school children and everything else, you know, and it seems like we're purging our sense of guilt or something like that. When we bring all these births to life and birth these children, and then does it stop there? You know, and those questions are, I think, are really significant to the whole issue, and also what it means to be pro-life in a, at the same time, you know, with the good arsenals that we have. How you can balance both of those. Just touching on so many other things, too.
I will, I just want to say about the development of representative, or politics, I mean political feelings, I think the author of the article in the Esquire magazine certainly got something like that in mind, because he constantly referred to the changing philosophies, ideas of this representative from their group, of course, who they figure was involved, what these guys were lost. Or considered to be lost from time to time, and their politics, their political decisions prove that, or tend to prove that, what we consider political decisions, you know, for whatever political wet or what.
This is an article in a leaf in Esquire that he got?
I think it's listed in, when I looked in San Francisco days ago, I know it was an old issue, but it was, I guess, fairly recent, fall of 83, here and there.
Forums on abortion that usually also gets around, and this is often difficult to say, I guess, to a Roman Catholic thing as well. I think in response to what Ralph was saying, many of the Catholic leaders in this group now have been really pro-life in a broad perspective, and are just as concerned about child care and anti-war and a whole other business, much more than they were before, and I think we ought to, you know, sing the Te Deums about that. On the other hand, I know certain parts of the country, sure, the Archdiocese of Chicago was organized by precincts for pro-life legislation and election candidates. Their parishes were organized throughout the whole, and they were politically committed. I'm not saying that's wrong or anything, but that's a fact. I mean, the priests told me, my friends the priests told me, it wasn't like it was a hidden thing. And that's a movement too. And without being anywhere anti-Catholic, I think that recognition of their conviction being used in that way has to be part of the discussion. I don't know how it helps us or not, but I think to ignore it is to ignore an important part of the movement.
Larry Rasmussen has three tapes on abortion in the mm-hmm. tape library, and he makes an interesting distinction between theological beliefs, moral action, and public policy. That those three things can inform one another, but they don't have to be the same. And they don't have to be consistent with each other even. That we can believe life is good, life is given by God, God is good, life is good. Our moral action may be, in some situations, abortion is the best choice. And our public policy may be abortion at any time. I mean, we could have different aspects of all. And all those, he says, those three areas need to be discussed as they are anyway. And I think that gets into where do we take our theological beliefs and how much public, do we want to make them public policy? There's a lot to consider in doing that. And she talks about that, but what are the consequences of those policies if we make them law?
I accept that to a point, but all policy comes from some, and it still comes from a belief system, it still comes from a moral system.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
So you can, I can acknowledge my system and understand that the public's, in a pro-society, we might be a different system. But sometimes I'd like to believe it's like policy just kind of falls out of the sky, but it doesn't come from anything.
Mm-hmm. There's no connection between the two. Mm-hmm. What are things that came up for you as you read the article? You thought about it? You had to consider it? Where did you hear the conversation?
Well, this is just a thought that flashed through my mind when you asked Ramona about where's the common ground between the two, and it seems like a really simple phrase, but the one that came to my mind is a concern for life, period, and just good, healthy, living life. And then the two questions that came after that for me is, what are the people who are, this may be phrasing in the negative, but what are the people who are, to use the label pro-choice, what are they trying to kill off? My sense is it's something bigger than a fetus or an emerging child, emerging life. And then the other question that came was, what are the people who are pro-life trying to protect by assuring that there's the other thing, whatever, not choice. So.
And that those might be the same thing?
Well, just, I don't know, just the questions came, that's all.
That's what was coming up for me, is that when I think about abortion, I sometimes think about it as the activity of handling an unwanted pregnancy. And sometimes I think about it as a power struggle between the way things are and on one level,
where the, some of the, you know, where the more repressive power can be, and the way things are experientially.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I know, I'm thinking, what can the church do about both of them? And I go back to the church because Parker Palmer, in his book, The Company of Strangers, sees the church as the one remaining public place we have. And, you know, I guess when this election came up in November, abortion was a big topic and women were a big topic. And, you know, what did we do about that? What did the church do about that? What did we say? How do we enter the fray of this now? I don't know, maybe I shouldn't ask you this question, you may not have an answer, but I guess I would suggest that the church think about that and do it. You know, when I thought about tonight, I thought, how should we talk about this? Should we talk about it as a debate? Should we talk about it as a forum? Should we talk about a new idea? And for me, it was, let's talk about a new idea. Let's see if there's any reconciliation in this, anywhere. You know, is that a more faithful thing to do? Or is it a more faithful thing to do to have debate? I don't know.
I think it's important, the reconciliation, because I think one of the problems our society has is that we close ourselves off to other opinions, right? And so, you know, we form principles, we form ideas, and that is the idea. And by not opening ourselves up to anything further, we don't grow, and we don't experience anything. And I think that's maybe how the church would get involved by offering, becoming, you know, if they want to stick to a pro-life, you know, say, you know, if they want to stick on that line, then start offering more counseling services, more services for the children after they're born. That, you know, that's the way that we're going to have to. But everybody has to be open. Like, I think one of the problems between pro-life and pro-choice is because, it's not conscious that they're closing themselves off, but that they have to realize that there's no way we can really close, because everybody's living in the same world, and we're all here, we have to work together, and, you know, we just, because they think one way, we can't avoid them. So the issue the issue has to be faced, right? And I think that a lot of people think that if we don't face the issue, the problem is going to go away, right? Nothing's going to change. And instead, we become more and more polarized, and then the confrontation is going to, you know, end where?
Yeah. Or what's going to emerge while we're not looking?
Yeah, I see very few people dealing with the issue of child care. And I think that's so critical. And I used to work in a social service agency, and most daycare centers are really struggling and having enormous trouble getting funds. And then you talk to parents, and it's just, and you know, most families, it's like both people have to work, or it might be a single parent who's in school or whatever. But it's just sort of,
yeah. And I was thinking in terms of the single woman parent, finds herself pregnant, who has a good job, whose insurance may or may not cover the cost of the pregnancy, whose job may or may not, you know, she may lose her job simply because she's a single woman who's pregnant. You know, those kinds of decisions that are, I think, come out of theology, out of doctrine, out of teachings of the church that are still somewhat, you know, very pervasive in terms of our social policies, our employment concerns, how we look kind of person. That's something I think the church maybe needs to look at.
Yeah, I think the church has enormous potential to be a model of something different.
Yeah. It's interesting to me that in my letter call, I had pregnancy leave. Is a part of the call. And I asked the question, does that mean that I can get pregnant, you know, and still stay a pastor? Obviously, no, that didn't what it meant. But the woman before me who was married did not have it in her letter of call, so that when she did get pregnant. So then they put it in and they just left it. But there would have been a difference. I could not have remained a pastor of that parish.
You mean you would have had to leave?
I would have had to have resigned and probably would maybe have experienced some sort of discipline from the hierarchy of the church. Because
why?
Being pregnant means that I had sex outside of marriage. And that is not recognized by the church.
Oh. Well, I get
that's what I'm saying.
I'm assuming you would have been married.
I'm just saying that, but it was sort of a joke. But, you know, as a single woman pastor, I mean, there it was in my letter of call, but I could never take advantage of it as a single woman pastor. Not that I wanted to either. You know, I mean, I was not planning my life that way. But,
you know, it also didn't enable you to plan your life.
But just even asking the question, and knowing that teachers have been fired, single women teachers have been fired because they're pregnant, they're not married. Where does that attitude come if not from, I think, the church?
It made me wonder if single men get fired if they're pregnant.
Would they admit?
Yeah.
Sure, they probably would.
No, not at all. Are you kidding?
Mm-hmm. Not fired from their teaching jobs, but probably from clergy jobs.
I'm not sure. Much less like anyway. There were just
yeah,
that's
a
double standard
yeah,
in there.
That's true.
Jackie, did you have a point? That was all I wanted to know. What frightens me? What's going on? Do they really want law to ban abortion?
Yes.
Do you know what an invasion of privacy that would be? I mean,
they don't think
they can't legislate that morality. That's what scares me. Because then if you had a miscarriage, would they come into your house and say, okay, let's investigate this miscarriage? And that really frightens me that they would ever dare to do that. That's between a woman, if she decides that, and her God, she's going to have to answer that. That's her moral responsibility. But that invasion of privacy is so frightening.
See, the other thing on that too is the upper middle class just flies down to Mexico or to Canada,
right,
and get an abortion.
Right, they got
so it's only the people, you know, the middle or lower class that really are molested.
Well, before the legislation passed that approved abortion, I said, remember the thalidomide baby? There was a lady here in this country who was sure she was going to have an armless labor baby, and she had to fly to Switzerland to get an abortion. But it really frightens me, that invasion of privacy, a woman's privacy, and it's men up there legislating and passing that law.
Not all. There are women legislators that don't want to see that either, but there are all women of people out there.
And it can frighten me because of, I suppose, because of where it could go. I mean, and maybe that's that section that where she talks about the therapeutic technological perspective or norm that to investigate a miscarriage, for instance, you know what is that saying about what's possible, I guess, or what we have control over, what we don't have control over. Who has rights to what territory? And I guess the womb is the territory I'm speaking of. Who does that belong to?
That woman. How can there be any doubt?
Yeah, well, but what I'm saying.
saying is that it, I suppose it could go that far as you're talking about it.
But the pro-life question is who does the fetus belong to?
Right, right.
The pro-life movement isn't questioning the woman. I mean, some pro-life movement is insensitive. It's not the issue. And that's the biggest miss on both parts is, in a sense, they're addressing different issues.
Yeah. But they're related, though.
Yeah, they're addressing different issues, thinking that they can be separate, and obviously they can't.
It's those children who've been, who were born, but they were so deformed or so ill or something that they couldn't live without a lot of technology supporting them, and the courts intervening, and when the parents said, no, let's not have the technology, and the courts intervening and said, yeah, use the technology because of it. It's that kind of thing. Who does the baby belong to? And I suspect that this co-creation model is a lot messier and more complex, as you say, than any of these other sides, and that must be what is so difficult. I guess I would hope that the church could somehow take this kind of idea and be able to talk about it, put more words to it, and so that it would also inform that kind of the new development that's out there on the horizon.
I'm still troubled by your questions and the choice of words.
Yeah, which one?
The killing off one. That's just a pretty loaded word.
Mm. Well, I don't know. I guess my assumption is that no one wants to kill off life. And in some sense, to have an abortion is to kill off life. I guess maybe that's the hard reality.
Yeah.
When you put it against, I mean, the other word you used was protecting mm-hmm. and killing off. And those two, to me, are real polarized.
Right, they feel real polarized.
Do you know anyone who had a natural abortion or a miscarriage?
Mm-hmm.
Did they have a funeral for that fetus?
No, but the woman was lost.
I know, but why didn't they have a funeral?
Because they hadn't told her that. No, the person hadn't told her that.
It depends on the time of the loss. In terms of funeral, it's kind of experience.
But 9 months, you would have been.
Yeah, but even earlier, if there's a memorial service is more logical than.
Do they have it?
Some do. Yeah, I don't know about 3 months. I'd say anything past the first trimester. That's absolutely important to do that. That is an answer.
Is your question to focusing on life? What is life? And it, I'm not sure I define that question.
It's a tough one for me because I believe in the power of choice, but I also don't necessarily think that abortion is the best option. I mean, I think it's the whole struggle about it is symptomatic of many other things in our culture. I think that's where I was coming at it from. I don't know why this question exactly. There was something that struck me, that the most moving thing that you said, I can't remember what the statement was, but it ended something with that what would it be like to look at the relationship between the woman and the emerging, or the, I don't know, the conception of life within the woman as a relationship
single organism.
A single organism, yeah. And that's pretty powerful. And then, so given that, what does it mean to have an abortion?
That's one thing that's sad in me, as a society as a whole, is what is the kind of brokenness that we can end up advocating in terms of holding abortion out as an option. Not as an option, as a good alternative. We do that as a society. To me, it creates a brokenness between probably the most intimate relationship there ever is.
But see, my other sense was that when Judy said that, I realized that I am so far from that single organism, because I'm a man. I don't have that oneness with that life in the same way. And I felt sort of humbled by it, like, I can't speak to that. I have to listen to women. I have to find out what they think about that, what that means to them, and what's coming out of that.
And my question is, how do women get to the plant? But also, do they choose to be pregnant? Do they have a plant for that? I think they express, I've heard it expressed the best that way, but I'm not so sure that all women who are pregnant experience that oneness either.
But isn't that still brokenness? Or is that the way it should
No,
be?
I think that it is not the norm to feel that oneness. I think we always hear people talking, women who are pregnant, talking about the life, and that is almost a separate part of her experience, the life going within me. There's a relationship, but not with oneness, that I heard Judy say, which I also found very meaningful, very striking. But I don't know how to represent that from that.
And a teenage girl who no one knew she was quite dead, and no one knew she was pregnant, and she denied until the day she had the baby, and she denied for a long time afterwards that she even knew she was pregnant. Mm-hmm. Several years later, she knew that she knew that she was.
And she missed. I mean, I'm hearing what you're saying about that. She missed something.
Homerslav was saying that we may want to have more respect for the symbiotic nature of the very early uterine life by regarding a woman and the fetus as a single organism, mm-hmm. with one informing consciousness, that of the woman. And it seems that brokenness is a part of that. I mean, you can talk about the brokenness between the woman and the fetus or the zygote or whatever is growing in her. But you could also talk about the brokenness of how is this an unwanted situation, the brokenness of adoption, the brokenness of marriages that are created out of that situation. You know, I mean, it's like, is that the word we want to use? Is it brokenness, or is that part of the setup that we're trying to look at and say something needs to change here? You know, that there's a brokenness period. I'm going to waft all over here, but one thing I thought you were saying, Ray, when you used the term the killing off, I guess I wasn't assuming you meant the killing off of an organism. Perhaps you were. I thought what you were saying was what is the power that the woman is trying to kill off? That situation that she is in where she has somehow or other lost control of her life. That patriarchal setup
I thought that you were saying it is a symbolic gesture. Mm-hmm. And what are the pro-lifers trying to protect, and the same thing that patriarchy. I thought that's what you were after.